Hack the Entrepreneur is part of Rainmaker FM, the digital business podcast network. Find more great shows and education at rainmaker.fm.
Welcome to Hack the Entrepreneur, the show which reveals the fears, habits, and inner battles behind big-name entrepreneurs and those on their way to joining them. Now here is your host, John Naster.
Hey, this is Hack the Entrepreneur. Thank you so much for joining me today. I'm your host, John Naster, but you can call me Johnny. My guest today is a brilliant entrepreneur who has built, grown, and sold four impressive companies. Over the past 20 years, he's been successfully leading teams and building products. Products that have been used by tens of millions of people and have generated millions upon millions of dollars in revenue. My guest has built and sold four companies, Compete.com, Lookery, Ghostery, and Performable. And he is currently focused on his latest business, Drift, where him and his team help businesses know, grow, and amaze their customers. Now, let's hack. David, cancel. We spent a lot of time on Hack the Entrepreneur talking about building an audience, building an email list, and then building a relationship with those people. I don't know about you, but I'm pretty sure that we don't in any way ever discuss the fact that email marketing is by far the best way to reach your customer, to deepen that relationship, and to make sales and generate revenue for your business. What we haven't really discussed is the fact that email works. Email works really, really well. It's absolutely, fully, completely proven. But what doesn't work is email marketing that is not targeted and not personalized. It's been proven companies using marketing automation will see 53% higher conversions than the rest of them. Active Campaign will enable you to send intelligent, driven emails based on customers' actions and their behaviors. Active Campaign will treat your contacts as unique individuals, which they are, and you need to remember that. Because rather than sending everyone the same message, Active Campaign will allow you to use marketing automation that can listen, learn, adapt, and respond, all based on your contacts' behavior and their customer profile as it changes. Plus, it's kind of cool because you don't have to hire consultants and people to set it up. It's a beautiful, easy-to-use platform that anyone can get started on today. Right now, you should go sign up for a free 14-day trial. There's no credit card needed, and you will see why thousands are upgrading to a more intelligent marketing solution. Visit activecampaign.com/hack. There'll be no training fees, no contracts, and pricing is accessible to any size business. Start marketing smarter today. Go to activecampaign.com/hack. We are back with another episode of Hack the Entrepreneur, and today we have a very, very special guest. David, welcome to the show.
Hey, John. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely my pleasure, and this is going to be an absolute blast, I can tell.
I'm excited.
Let's do it. David, as an entrepreneur, can you tell me what is the one thing that you do that you feel has been the biggest contributor to your successes so far?
I spent a lot of time thinking about this. I think it's easy. It's my obsession with learning. And the more that you progress in life and the more experience that you have, the harder I think learning becomes. Because as you become more experienced, you need to become or teach yourself to be more and more humble in order to learn. As we all have egos get in the way, and we need to be able to turn them off to be able to learn.
Nice. I like that. Is this something that you picked up along the way, or is this like an innate sort of trait within you, this the obsession with learning?
I've always had it. So I've always had this natural curiosity and this thirst, I'm not even sure why, to want to learn more. And it just so happened that that was a skill that was useful in this context, right? And sometimes it becomes, for some people, it's not useful because it could mean that they're the troublemaker, you know, usually in school or maybe in university or in your company, in a more corporate environment. But for an entrepreneur, it's actually a great trait to have. And so I just got lucky to have a trait that actually worked in this context.
So in school, they're troublemakers, and in business, they're disruptors, I believe.
I think it's something like that.
It's a skill that's really, it's essential, right? It's essential to, I mean, I guess to not always follow rules, and but also want to push yourself further and further. I think it's kind of an essential trait.
I think so too. I think it's, you know, and it is the thing that keeps me motivated, keeps me going. It keeps me wanting to create new companies and new products and continue to learn, is this kind of nonstop obsession with progression. And I think we all have them, right? We all have this, some more than others. I think as all organisms, you know, we're focused on one thing, which is growth and survival. And so, you know, some of us like myself are more obsessed than others. And this is the thing that motivates me more than other tangible things, whether it's financial or whether it's something specific that I learn. It's always this progression of wanting to get better.
Nice. Could you define entrepreneurship for me?
You know what? I've never thought about this. So let's see if we can do it on the fly. I think part of the reason that I've really never spent time thinking about this was that I started doing this 20 years ago, so a long time ago now. And back then, if you can remember, like, at least for me, entrepreneurship was kind of like a dirty word. Mm-hmm. Right now, it's hard to remember that now. Now it's kind of glamorized. But back then, you know, an entrepreneur to me meant someone who was selling door to door, someone who was creating an infomercial on TV, you know, as seen on TV products, or someone who was doing something like that, kind of get rich quick scheme. And I never thought about it in the context of building companies. And of course, you know, there were people doing that. And I think it was just something that I didn't see. I didn't see that part of entrepreneurship. So I never, you know, and I tried not to call myself an entrepreneur. I was just obsessed with building products and then later companies. And really, it wasn't until recently that I got comfortable with that word. So I think for me, entrepreneurship is about wanting to solve a problem and then becoming so focused on solving that problem or that wrong that we see in the world, right? That we end up creating products and services and eventually companies in order to fix that problem. So we see something that is broken and we want to try and fix it.
Yeah. Don't wait for someone else to fix it. Fix it yourself.
Exactly.
So I think what you refer back to, I mean, from 20 years ago, those people, we used to call them like businessmen and stuff.
Yes.
And like nobody ever says, like, I've never introduced myself as a businessman. I've introduced myself as an entrepreneur many times, but it's weird, right? So I've never actually asked anybody that question, David. I might start though, because I loved your answer. But the reason why I asked you is because my definition that I've given 100 times on this show of entrepreneurship is actually the tagline of your blog. I make something out of nothing. And to me, it's like, you can be a musician, you can be an artist, or you can be building software. But if you're creating something out of nothing, to me, that is the definition of entrepreneurship.
I love the way that you frame that. And yes, I've used that tagline for years. And I think what I loved about what you said is that that's how I've always thought about this, is that this is a creative pursuit. And to me, it's not different than my friends who are painters or writers or carpenters or furniture makers or whatever they make. They end up making, we're all in the creative process. And actually a lot of the things that I've really leaned into now are things that are not common in the technology space that we're in, but is very common ways of thinking for other makers who have been doing this longer than we have.
Yeah. That's a great. So again, I apologize for putting you on the spot. I promised you before we started I wouldn't, and then I did. So this 20 years ago, let's go back to this time. Because oftentimes, David, when we're going through this process, it doesn't always make sense. But when we look back on it, especially back 20 years, it probably is a lot more clear to us. So looking back, there seems to be oftentimes this time in every entrepreneur's life when they realize one of two things. That either they had this calling to make this huge difference in the world and I guess to solve those problems, or they found that they were just simply kind of unemployable and couldn't work for somebody else anymore. So David, looking back, can you tell me which side of the fence you see yourself on? And then what was it that caused that in you 20 years ago?
Ooh, that's a great question. I think, you know, my wife would definitely say that I always needed to be an entrepreneur because I'm not good at being told what to do, right? So I don't have that skill. So I'm not very good at other people telling me what to do. So I never really liked working for someone else. And I, you know, for me, I'd say a lot of it had to do with having this obsession with learning, wanting to get better, and then feeling both in school and then later in work that the people that I wanted to be around, people who were passionate about solving a big problem and passionate about what they did specifically. And in most environments that I was in early on, I didn't find many people who were passionate. I found people who did a great job, but they weren't necessarily passionate about what they were doing. And I kind of fell into an early stage company and saw that everyone around me was passionate and they were great designers and engineers and product people and business people and sales people and marketing people. And everyone shared that same sense of purpose and that same passion for what they did specifically. And I was, you know, hooked.
Really? Is this isn't HubSpot, right?
No, this is a long, long time ago. This was 1996.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, long time ago.
You have looking through your LinkedIn, you have a serious track record of starting companies, getting them acquired, starting another company, getting it acquired, starting another company. It's an impressive link. I look at a lot of LinkedIn profiles. This one is impressive.
Oh, thank you.
So
this was a long time ago. This is a different company.
Okay. So I want to know though, how did you deal with this? Because Performable, right? You were the mm-hmm. CEO and founder of Performable 2009 to 2011. So almost 2 years, and you got acquired by HubSpot.
Yes.
Where you then went to work for just over 3 years as their chief product officer.
Mm-hmm.
And you've said twice, I believe, in the past 9 minutes, that you really don't like to work for somebody else.
Yeah.
And you don't do well getting told what to do. So how did you use this sort of as to push to propel your obsession with learning mm-hmm. and to grow while being in? I'm assuming that the working for them became a part of the deal in the acquisition, and then you had to push yourself through it and still kind of get something out of it.
Yeah, great question. So interesting. I had other companies acquired before Performable, and I never went along with any of the acquisitions. I was always the person leaving at the time of acquisition. And so I never felt like I wanted to work anywhere else. I would just wanted to create my own companies. But something was different about the Performable acquisition. What was different was that I knew the HubSpot team. They were local for a long time before they started the company, as well as the advisors. And we had almost identical cultures at Performable and HubSpot and very similar messages. And I felt like if we were to merge the companies that we could try to create a once in a lifetime company, actually try to create something that is an anchor company here in Boston. Maybe eventually we were dreaming that we'd be able to go public and we'd be able to create something that we could look back at and had a big impact. And so that had to do with it. And then the other thing, selfishly, back to my learning, was that the biggest any of my companies had ever gotten to was about 200 employees. And so I had multiple times seen between 0 to 200. So what does it take to go from 0 to 10 to 50 to 100 to 200? I knew that playbook at least pretty well. You don't know everything. And at HubSpot, at the time of the acquisition, we were just about 200 people. And so I really wanted to learn, what does it take to go from 200 to 1,000 through rapid scale? I had never seen that side of it, both from not only from a product standpoint, but from a company standpoint, from a culture standpoint, from a sales, marketing, services standpoint, just like, what does that look like? And so that's what I did for the next three and a half years at HubSpot, and went from that 200 to 1,000 something employees, went from, you know, 2,000 customers to 15,000 customers, and got us to the point where we went public. And then at that point, I left to start a new company.
Wow. That's impressive. That's a better answer than I could have imagined.
So it was about learning. Back to, you know, your original question, it had a lot to do with learning. And also the reason why I left at the time that I did when we went public had to do with learning again. You know, I felt like I got to that 1,000-person mark. We got to the point that we could bring the company public. Everything was in a good state and very solid from my teams. And I felt like I didn't necessarily want to learn, you know, post IPO, you know, 1,000 to 2,000. I think there's a lot of interesting things to learn there. I think there was HubSpot was an amazing place to learn those things, but I at this time didn't want to learn that lesson.
Yeah, and fair enough. So with knowing, I mean, you were acquired, so that was great. You got to merge with a company that aligned with your with Performable really, really well, and you got to see this 200 to 1,000 really quickly and a mass like onslaught of new customers and just growth to IPO. Mm-hmm. But was it still a difficult transition from you at the top to you at the top of a department?
Not as difficult as you would think. And that was because HubSpot was a very unorthodox place, a great place. And we, to give you some context, we as a management team met only once a month. So a lot of management teams I know meet weekly, if not more often. So we only came together once a month as a management team. Otherwise, we were, each leader was running their area kind of in parallel. I don't want to say that we were isolated. We weren't, right? We had the same goals, but we were really focused on sprinting as fast as possible in each department. And we would come back together as an executive team once a month, get in sync, and then again, go back and focus on our in our areas. And sometimes we had to work with each other during that, but a lot of times we were running as fast as possible within the team. So it was odd. It was different. It was fantastic. And because of that, I never really felt like, and none of the other folks really felt like they worked for anyone. Mm-hmm. We had clear goals. And then in turn, we ran our teams that way. I didn't want my team to feel like they necessarily worked for me. I was there to support them and to enable them and to get out of their way. And Brian, who was our CEO and is still the CEO, did that with me as well. He was there to support and get out of our way. And I didn't have that typical, you know, manager kind of relationship.
I love it. I love it. And now we're done with HubSpot. So I want to sort of move on. We've talked for 10 minutes or 12 minutes about you, some things that you're amazing at, like new product ideas, taking them to companies, building them up to like full-size companies almost, and then like getting them acquired, moving on, even going to work for HubSpot and scaling that. And now every like expert these days talks about the 80-20 rule in business. Mm-hmm. So you're supposed to do 20% of the work and you'll get 80% of the results. You're supposed to do what you're good at and delegate the rest. David, can you tell me something within business that you are absolutely not good at?
lots of things. I'd say almost all of them have lots of things. I'd say one area is that I'm not really good at the middle. And to me, I define the middle as the day-to-day process and the data, and in some cases, the details. And I'm really good at high-level stuff and all the high level things, and then like setting goals and setting our direction. And then I like being in the getting in the weeds and supporting the team and giving feedback and talking to customers and doing all the stuff that on the surface look like they don't scale because it's all the one to one time. And then all the stuff in the middle is where I try to bring in colleagues who are way better at that and passionate about those areas, and whether that's, you know, someone who's, you know, a product manager or someone who's runs sales or someone who runs marketing. I don't think I can do any of those jobs as anywhere, you know, 10% as well as they do. And so they run those areas and, you know, I focus on the where are we going and what are the boundaries we need to stay in. Those are the guardrails that I use. And then just helping day to day, removing roadblocks and talking to customers and being the advocate and being the person who goes and buys the M&Ms because we're at M&Ms or, you know, doing anything that, or cleaning the office or washing dishes or what have you. Whatever needs to be done, I will go do that and get the roadblocks out of my team's way.
I love that. You seem like you are an amazing leader. Just even the way you talked about it with HubSpot, the way you worked with your teams, and now just, I mean, to admit that you would go and get the M&Ms if that was what needed to be done, you wouldn't be like, well, no, I'm the founder of this thing. I don't do that.
No, I'm the first to do that. And, you know, that's something that we look for and I look for in bringing in different leaders and bringing in basically everyone on the team sharing that same ethos that we are here to serve. And the higher your title is, the more your job is to serve others. And so, you know, at the top of our at the top of the inverted pyramid is our customers, and then is the individual, then are the individual contributors within the company. And the higher your title is, at least on paper, the lower you are in that inverted pyramid. And with me being at the very bottom.
Yeah. With you being at the very bottom. And I have to admit, you have a confidence behind admitting the list of things that you are not good at, more so than somebody who is 2 years into this 20-year journey that you are in. I think it takes a real maturity and going through the multiple companies and ideas and probably just a giant list of mistakes you've made to realize, I think, something that I actually saw you tweet, I'm going to say about 4 hours ago, that is, no one is an expert at everything, and how it's so simple to say, but it's hard for us to live by.
Oh, so hard. I find I'm always repeating this almost to everyone that I talk to, and that's especially inside of Drift. It's that all the great things that I've heard, and they've all been, you know, I've learned the painful way, all these things, are the simplest things to say and the hardest things to do. And I find and why I keep repeating the same simple lessons is that they're all simple. Like, all the answers are actually right in front of us, and they're all, and we know them, and they're very simple, but they're not easy to do, especially when you're when you're anxious or when you're in the early stages or you're stressed out. Like, they're the easy things to forget, but they are the things that we need to focus on.
Beautifully said. Beautifully said. All right, David, let's move on to projects.
Mm-hmm.
So projects as a loose term, I mean, we can take projects as Drift as a company if you mm-hmm. want, but you've started a lot of things. The idea of making and creating something out of nothing sort of really runs true and through you, I believe. So take it as either a big project or just a project now within Drift. I would love to know, with all the ideas I'm sure that come through your head, I'm sure that come through your inbox from people hitting you with ideas, how is it, whether it's a written process or just an internal process, but what is the process you go through, something like today, to decide that a project is worth your time, energy, and resources?
Good question. So I think about this a lot. So my method might not work for you, but the method that has worked for me is that I write everything down, but then I almost never go back and reread my notes or my to-dos that I've written down. And that works for me because I find that it becomes too easy to be focused on checking things off on a to-do list and then having the feeling that we've accomplished something, when in reality, most of the things on the to-do list didn't actually have any meaningful impact. And so I write them down to get them out of my head. And then I only focus each day on the things that keep coming back up. No matter how many times I've written them down, I can't get them out of my head. And so those are the things that I pursue that are new. And then the other things that I'm pursuing are the things that are according to our operating plan. And then the things that I'm hearing from customers or prospects or the market. These are the different things that I'm kind of focused on. And each day, you know, we as a company really subscribe to this idea of the one thing. And that is that we try to find each day the one thing or the one big rock that you can focus on for that day that's going to have the biggest impact on the company. And we focus on that. And that can be a 5-minute task, or that can be an all-day task. And then focus on getting that done. And then, you know, the rest of your time, you can fill in with different things of different priority levels. But like, all that matters each day is that you've pushed one big rock forward. It doesn't matter that you check 20 things off a to-do list. What matters is we made progress on the one thing that matters.
Yeah, I love this idea. I'm assuming it's from the book.
Yes, exactly.
The one thing. So how long have you guys been using this one thing?
I've been using it unknowingly for a long time, for probably a decade or so, just because this was my personality. And I was the person that would always try every to-do list and every task manager and GTD this and that. And none of them ever worked for me. And so I kind of defaulted into this state of just like, well, what's the highest priority thing? And let me just focus on that. I never had a name to it. And so when I read the book, I was like, wow, this is what I've actually been doing. And like, a lot of books that we identify with are the ones that kind of reinforce what we already think.
Yep.
And so this was like already my thought process and what I was doing. And I shared it with the team. And it's probably been like 6 months, 6 to 9 months, something like that, everyone has, I gave it out as a gift and everyone has read the book and people really subscribe to this idea. And especially for someone like us, our company, which is super early stage, it's kind of helps you stay calm in the thick of it, right? Because as most of your listeners probably have heard, like the startup journey is kind of up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down every day. And this happens in all walks of life. It's just accelerated in this stage of a company. And so really having the team focus on around this one thing has really helped people keep focused and calm during those up and downs movements.
Yeah. And so then that's a great way to keep your sort of momentum and your focus on moving your company forward when it needs to. So I need to now even step it back further to, I really want to know where you come up with these ideas to start these clubs. Because I've actually gone now down further on your LinkedIn thing since we've been talking. And at the beginning of it is compete.com, which is so all these tools and websites that I've used for like 5 years. It's like, wow, this is the guy who created both of these.
That's funny.
So where do these ideas come from? Like, say, let's talk about Drift. The idea for Drift, where does it come from? And then what are you going through to determine that, yes, this is, because there's competition for Drift. There is.
I think that's great.
Exactly. So could you tell me what that is?
Yeah. So I'd say one thing before I answer that question is that what you mentioned at the end, that there's competition, I think is an important point, because, and one of the big lessons that I've learned throughout my career, which is like, I build B2B software. And so I want to lean into competition. So competition, or something that someone would perceive as a red ocean of, is actually a good thing. That means that it's a pain that people have identified. It means that people are paying to solve that pain today. And it probably means that the solutions that are out there are probably ripe, at least in some niches, to be disrupted, right? There's a lot of pain. There's a lot of money. There's a lot of need. And so, and I find like a lot of times kind of early entrepreneurs, and I made this mistake myself, like first time, kind of want to shy away from competition and they want to move toward categories that don't exist, or they want to invent something because they believe this myth of the inventor. And our job as entrepreneurs is largely as innovators. Innovation is very different from invention. And for some reason, we're stuck on this idea of it, wanting to invent something that doesn't exist. I don't ever want to invent something that doesn't exist. I want to innovate in an existing area of pain because that's what people care about. And I want to make it 10x, 100x, 1000x better. But to answer your question about like ideas and how do I come up with these things, I think that's also progressed for me in my career. And now I really care about two things. I care about when starting a company or how these things come to light. I think about a market that I'm interested in. So, you know, I start thinking about a market, a type of customer, kind of a pain that I'm seeing in that market. And then the other thing that that I'm looking at is like changes that are happening either in that market or external to that market that might make that market ready to be kind of reinvented or innovated upon. And so like if those two things are happening, like then that's an area that I try to lean into. Now, and the actual idea or the starting idea almost doesn't matter, because by definition, it's going to be wrong. You know, it's wrong in every single case, every single company, every single idea. And that's true outside of entrepreneurship. That's true in writing, and that's true in painting, and it's true in any creative pursuit. The first version is never the final version, right? That is a myth that we need to help to dispel. It's an iterative process. And so the idea matters the least. What really matters is the market, the momentum that's happening outside of market that may let you do something unique within that market. And then for you to get as quickly as possible to this iterative process of testing, getting feedback, building, testing, feedback, and doing as many cycles of this as possible, which is hard because we have to, again, put our ego to the side and say, but John really has this idea that he's passionate about and he wants to do this idea, but the market might not care about your idea. The market might care about their idea. And so the ability to put your idea to the side and say, no, I'm here to solve a pain, even if it's not my initial idea, is a hard one, but it's a valuable one that we need to learn.
Yeah. I love that. And I like this idea of don't worry about it because it's going to be wrong. Your first, and we hear this, right? That your product has to iterate and evolve, or your idea, because it's not going to be right at the beginning. It just never is.
Mm-hmm.
So let's, can we make it concrete? How has Drift evolved in the past year and a half?
Radically, if you were to ask people who know the company, who have watched what we've been doing. But to me, it's not, it's all part of the same process, right? It's kind of like following this path, right? And this path is going left and right. And, but it's always been around the same thing. We started the company focused on really exploring all the new stuff that we were seeing on the consumer side of things, specifically in mobile and some on the web, about like how new generations, and this is the market change, how new generations and how people are changing the way that they communicate with each other and also with companies. And, you know, whether that's, you know, now you're Snapchatting a company, or now you're, you know, doing a live Periscope in one click versus, you know, back, you know, in the old days, you know, to set up a GoToMeeting involved a 10-digit code and like downloading software and all this stuff. Like, communication patterns were changing radically, and how fast someone could communicate with either a brand, a company, or an individual had radically changed in the last, you know, 3 to 5 years. And so we started out by thinking we're going to do something in communication, whether it's communication with each other within the company or communication between the company and the customer. And we set out to focus on a series of experiments. And so, like, if you were to watch the company, you would see all these different experiments that don't look like they're related. One of them, the most public of them, was an iPhone and Mac app that we created called Annotate. And Annotate was a visual communication experiment we did, and basically let you take screenshots and video clips and then let you annotate and communicate about those things. And right, if you look at that and you look at where Drift is today, you see almost no connection. But to me, there's actually a very tight connection between those things. The visual communication was just a method of communicating. And what we learned through that was that the biggest users of those apps were product people and some sales and marketing people. And they were doing it, they were using it both internally, but they were using it also externally to communicate to their customers. And a simple example of that is that, you know, we all know that it's easier to point at a picture and to annotate it and to describe something on it than it is to write out something in text, in prose, right? And so it was a shortcut method of communication, whether it was like, hey, check out this new feature, or do these three things in order to use this product that we just sold you. And so the more that we dug into that, even though we were doing visual communication, the more we saw, hey, the bigger problem here is just how do companies and customers communicate with each other? That's the bigger problem. That's like the meta problem that they're trying to solve. And this is just one version of it. And then that led us, of course, to start to experiment there and then be able to look back at our own experiences and say, hey, wait a second, we had this problem at HubSpot. And then, you know, our friends at this other company had the same problem. Oh, and this company we know over here has the same problem. We all have the same problem, but it took us going through this kind of process to be able to then look back even at ourselves and say, wow, we created all these workarounds and we had this problem with, and it was painful, and wow, you know, we didn't have a solution for this. And we built a lot of homegrown software, which is always a clue for entrepreneurs in the B2B space. Like, what you're trying to do is replace Excel largely and homegrown software, right? And so we could look back and say, okay, this is a problem that we had ourselves. Our, you know, our friends in lots of different other companies are still having this problem. And then we'll go out and solve this problem. That's how we came to Drift.
Brilliant. I love it. And just self-awareness, team awareness, and all being very humble to be willing to accept that your idea needs to change and evolve to a better product. I love that.
Exactly. And as you said, it's simple, not easy, right?
Exactly.
It's simple to say that, and hard to throw away the thing that you've built. Hard to say, that wasn't it, but this is it. It's hard to do all that stuff. And it's very simple to say and hard to do.
Yeah, I love it. All right, David, this has been an absolute blast. I want to wrap up on one final question for you. This idea I'm working with, calling the entrepreneurial gap. So you've had an amazing career, I'm going to just say it, for 20 years of building companies, building another company, acquisition, all the way now to Drift. Oftentimes, as entrepreneurs, we live in this sort of gap sometimes because we never sometimes see ourselves as successful because our success is always in the future. So in 1 month when you hit this metric, in 1 year when you get this acquisition, you'll be successful. Yet right before you hit that, you want 5 or 10 loftier ones into the future. No matter what it looks like from the outside, how successful we look like to everyone else, to ourselves, we just keep looking ahead. And like walking towards the horizon, the further you walk, the further it gets away. I would love it right now, David, if you could stop and turn and look behind you at everything you've accomplished, the highs, the lows, the wins, and the losses, and tell me how you feel about your career up until today.
Well, I feel like you have a microphone in here because I was just talking about this today with my co-founder, and we talk about it often. So if I were to look at my career, I feel like I'm grateful and I'm, you know, very lucky for everything that I've done. But I'd say at the root of it, I feel like I still haven't done it yet. And that's not to say that I'm not grateful. I'm incredibly grateful, but I don't. And that's probably what keeps me going and why I want to keep learning. I feel like I still have something to prove. I haven't lived up to whatever I think my own potential is.
That's why you're an entrepreneur. I just want you to know from my seat here, you are kicking ass and you have kicked ass.
Thank you.
I just want you to know that. Yeah. But I'm glad that you're not totally satisfied and you want to continue because I can't wait to see what else you come up with.
Thank you so much, John.
David, we've got to talk about Drift in passing. Could you specifically tell the listener about Drift and where to find out more about it and also where they can track you down online?
Sure. You can find Drift on Twitter. DRIFT is our handle. Our website is drift.com, and Drift helps businesses communicate with their customers, specifically inside of their, on their website or inside of their product, whether that product's a web product or a mobile product. And it lets sales teams connect with their prospects as they're visiting the website or visiting their product, and lets customer success and support and product teams engage their customers while they're actually using the product. So instead of, we all know that, you know, phone, it's hard to get someone on the phone, right? So that's like a 2% open rate, and email is probably like a 20% open rate. But for your customers who are engaged using your product, why jump out to another communication channel when you could get 100% open rate right on your product or website and communicate to them where it matters most to them, which is at the right time in the right place.
And this is via Slack now? Did I see this?
Yeah, we have an integration now that we released today that lets you, instead of having to log into our app to be able to communicate with your customers, we'll send the messages directly to your Slack installation so that you can chat to them on there. So your workflow as a team member doesn't change at all, but you're actually talking to your customers that are visiting your website or inside of your product via Slack. And we have other integrations coming, whether it's Salesforce or HubSpot or what have you, so that you don't have to change the way that you work, but that you can better connect with your customers.
I love it. I love it. As soon as I saw that Slack, I need to try this for Hack the Entrepreneur.
Oh, please do. Tell me what you think.
That's because it's now working. I don't have to change my workflow. It's there. It's on my phone. It's on my desktop.
Exactly. Already. Nothing new to learn. And then for myself, you can find me at Twitter. My handle is dcancel. That's D. And then the word cancel, like cancel a check, C-A-N-C-E-L, and then davidcancel.com.
Excellent. So davidcancel.com and Twitter for both Drift and David, as well as drift.com and Gary Keller's The One Thing. I will link to all those in the show notes on Hack the Entrepreneur. So when you are done working out, done walking, done biking, done commuting, they'll be there waiting for you. Make sure you reach out to David on Twitter or wherever you'd like to find him. Also, check out that LinkedIn profile. Jeez. David, thank you so much for stopping by. I really, truly do appreciate you taking the time. And please keep doing what you're doing because it is awesome and inspiring to watch.
Same to you. Thank you for having me, John. And look forward to hearing more episodes.
Wow. That was a fun conversation. I really, truly do hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. And I was in no way joking or kidding when I was looking at David's LinkedIn profile. And so this is something I do. I have a couple of monitors here in front of me, and I'll have screens open with information or a picture for sure of my guest. Kind of helps it be more personal. We don't do videos, so to get the better audio quality for you. And I hadn't scrolled all the way down his LinkedIn profile because he's built and sold four brilliant companies already, and he's done a lot of things I didn't even get down. And then it was compete.com, which I've literally been using for years, and it was cool that he started it. And Ghostery is another product that I still run. It runs as a add-on to my Chrome, and it's an extension. And it right before I got on the call with him, actually, I discovered he created Ghostery, and I was like, geez, along with 35 million other people apparently that use it now. But still, it was a cool conversation, super just nice, generous, genuine guest to have on, and I really appreciate it. And so it was fun because I was taking a lot in and just really enjoying the conversation, and we were kind of going off certain places because it's not very often you get to sit down with somebody of that caliber and with that experience and just generosity to share and answer anything that I'm willing to ask him. And so luckily it's recorded, right? So I get to go back and listen to it. I get to go back before you do even and listen to it. And so I did, and I went back through and I noticed there was 9 things that sort of stood out to me. So I went back again and I got it down to 7. I went back again and I got it down to 4. Then I got it down to 3 and I got it down to 2. Then there was this one thing that David said. It was so very, very clear to me the last time I listened to it. It was the one. It was it. Did you get it? Did you hear it? Let's do it. Let's find the hack.
I build B2B software, and so I want to lean into competition. So competition, or something that someone would perceive as a red ocean of, is actually a good thing. That means that it's a pain that people have identified. It means that people are paying to solve that pain today. And it probably means that the solutions that are out there are probably ripe, at least in some niches, to be disrupted, right? There's a lot of pain. There's a lot of money. There's a lot of need.
And that's the hack. David. This is awesome. Learning to lean into the competition, because you're absolutely right. And I really admire that you said this is a mistake you made early on. You've been at this for 20 years. So you have a lot of experience on a lot of us here today. But this, I had to look up this red ocean. He mentioned this, how most people think of the red ocean. And I didn't know. Probably thought I did, but I didn't. So I went and I looked it up. And Wikipedia says the Blue Ocean Strategy was from a book called The Blue Ocean Strategy. And it says here companies try to outperform their rivals to grab a greater share of product or service demand. As the market space gets crowded, as David was just saying, prospects for profits and growth are reduced. Products become commodities or niche, and cutthroat competition turns the ocean bloody, hence the term red ocean. And most people want to avoid a red ocean filled with blood of other businesses. But I fully 100% agree with David, where this is telling you that this is not a bad thing. This is a good thing because it tells you that there's a pain in the marketplace, and the pain equals people paying to solve that. A lot of pain, a lot of people looking because they have that pain, and then a lot of money being spent to solve that pain. Those are things you want to look for in your marketplace. Laura Roeder was on from Edgar, and she was on a few months back. I'll link to it in the show notes, but she was on, and I asked her the same thing too, because she entered a marketplace of software that from the outside looks like it's like you shouldn't be going after that market because the competition is too stiff, too good, too entrenched. And her answer was like David's, both very, very successful entrepreneurs, which was no, because that tells you that the market is profitable. That tells you that people are willing to pay to solve that pain. And I also like how Laura and David say that, yeah, there'll be people paying within that market for the existing products and services, but there's going to be a percentage of those people that will just naturally switch to a new product anyways to try it out, because you'll be different than them. You'll be solving the same pain point, but in a different way. And that allows you to then grasp a hold of a certain portion of that market. And if the market's big enough, that portion that you can grab can be enormous, absolutely enormous. So think of the red ocean. And next time you think of an idea and a business and a market you want to enter and you see a red ocean of competition, maybe think again and think about actually heading into that market anyways. Because it's worked for David and it's worked for him very, very well. David, thank you so very much. All right, hacktheentrepreneur.com/review. If you are an Apple or an iTunes user, that would help me so much if you stopped by there and left me a rating and a review for the show. It really, really, truly does help. hacktheentrepreneur.com/review. That'd be very cool of you. That'd be very cool. And if you can, people have been doing it and I appreciate it, is drop your Twitter handle in there. I'll give you a follow. I'll follow you on Twitter and I will thank you because I can't get to do that, unfortunately, with iTunes. They don't allow it. But if you leave your at your name in the review, then I know who you are and I would love to track you down, see what you're doing on Twitter. And I would also like to just thank you personally. So do that. hacktheentrepreneur.com/review. With that being said, I truly thank you for stopping by, taking the time. It really does truly mean a lot to me. And please, until next time, keep hacking the entrepreneur.